and welcome to episode 20 of the Spooktator podcast. I'm your host, Hayley Stevens, and joining me for this episode is one of my co-hosts, Charlie Revel-Smith.
Hello, everyone.
Hi. And we're also joined by Ben Radford for this episode. Ben is the deputy editor of Skeptical Inquiry magazine, which many of our listeners may be familiar with. He's also a paranormal investigator and researcher, author of many books. Your latest one is called Ghost Investigation. It's about, I read a preview copy, and it's basically like a complete guide to ghost investigation. You've also written about El Chupacabra and so on and so forth. So welcome to the show, Ben.
Thanks. Good to be on. I guess I'm the one without the accent, or at least it seems that way to me. So,
yeah, we would normally have more of us here, but we have kind of dropped like flies. And in the last few minutes, we had some technical difficulties getting online, but we're online now. And hopefully, touch wood, which is really unskeptical, but touch wood, nothing else will go wrong. Now, to start with, well, Charlie, have you been up to anything interesting lately? We normally do a catch-up, don't we, at the beginning?
What have I been up to? Well, I've published a book. I have the third of my Bristol Murders books. It's called The Bristol Savage. It's just come out. It's been selling very nicely. And other than that, I have been trying to stay warm in this like miserably cold weather that suddenly struck us. We had snow 2 days ago.
In Bristol?
Like, for 20 seconds. It was still winter. I was, where have you come from? I thought you were gone. But yeah, other than that, it's been pretty much a nice, light time of the year for me. Not much going on.
Good. Yeah. Well, yeah, same here, really. Not much going on. No snow here, though. I'm Bradford-on-Avon. Ben, where are you in the world? What's the weather like where you are?
I'm in New Mexico, sort of in the southwest in the desert region. And normally this time of year, it's actually pretty nice, although today we're getting some rather gusty winds. So it's blowing some stuff around outside, which is annoying me to no end. But I'm doing my best to I've got a cat behind me, and I've got some Earl Grey tea. So I'm ready to talk ghosts.
Brilliant. Yeah, well, nice. talking ghosts is what we do. It's what we do best. Though we're kind of talking ghosts and other stuff in this episode. So, yeah, a variety, really. I don't know if in the States you get most haunted still, or if you ever got most haunted.
I've seen a few clips here and there. I honestly don't watch that much cable TV ghost shows. I used to, but I got so I would throw things at the TV.
Yeah.
I went through too many TVs. I can't do this anymore. And so between the Finding Bigfoot shows and Ghost Hunters and their 10th season of not finding ghosts, I sort of gave up.
They're all so incredibly generic now. All of those ghost shows are virtually identical to each other, and nothing ever happens. They're also incredibly boring.
They are. Well, you say that, but as anybody out there who watches Most Haunted will know, they've just started a new season. I can't remember which season it is. Season 100, let's call it, because they've been going for a long, long time.
At least it seems that way.
Yeah, it definitely does seem that way. And I think it's episode 2 has just aired, or aired very recently, and they claim that they caught evidence of ghosts on camera. And everybody has gone a bit kind of doolally about this. Oh, we're going on a walk with Charlie.
Yeah, sorry, I've just got a warning about my power levels, so I'm actually going for a little wander to go plug it.
It's so weird.
I've never seen that before. Getting a tour of the inside of his house.
Yes, this is all extremely professional.
Now, Hayley, watch for any dark figures behind him.
I know, yeah. I know.
Shadow figures. No. Yeah.
Actually, ooh. Having said this, right. I think I'd probably do better off just staying in this room. Actually,
wasn't that on one of the Paranormal Activity movies where she's on the laptop and then you see the door open behind her and someone walks past the door? Good, good. Yeah, I'm glad that doesn't... Can you imagine that happened? That would just be, like, so weird, but also we would then get accused of staging it. And then Charlie would be led there dead. Right. and everyone will be like, oh, it's all staged.
Like, oh, it's got attention seekers.
Yeah. He didn't die, really.
Yes.
Like, don't call an ambulance. It's ridiculous. But anyway, going back to Most Haunted, they claimed that they recently caught evidence on camera on, I think it was episode 2 of the latest season, and it's really kind of gripped people. Lots of paranormal investigators and ghost hunters are talking about it, and I'm going to try and play it. I'm going to see if I can do that screen sharing thing. I don't think I can play the audio, because I don't think my microphone will pick it up. Let's see if I can share this.
I suspect it's just as impressive with or without the audio.
Yeah, probably. So you're all going to see my screen now, which is very unprofessional. I'm going to present that to everyone. It's a bit of a... So let's just go here. Full screen, and then I'll just play it. Can you guys see that? I don't know if you can see that.
I can see it, yep.
Yep.
Good job.
Okay, so basically this is Stuart and Carl. I'll give you some background. Stuart and Carl are doing a lone investigation where they've gone off on their own in the building that they're investigating. And they claim they've heard a noise down this hallway that you can see here. And what we're about to see is the ghost that everybody's been talking about. So Carl's just putting the camera down so they can go investigate. That's his hand.
And he's pointing out where...
They're pointing out where they're hearing noises coming from. And there we go. There goes somebody up some steps.
I can see that, yes.
Yep, and they're just pointing it out. And I think at this point Stuart's saying, I can see it down there. And, then they go running after it. Now... Oh gosh, how do I stop doing this? Exit full screen. Ignore this. You can't see any of this. Stop. Right. Yes. So that's the evidence that everybody is kind of wetting themselves about. And
well, if it's a ghost, it's all right. It's pretty good evidence of ghosts, but it looks like it's just a person, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there are some.
That way to me. I don't there know.
I wouldn't be that cynical, Charlie. No, I think it is just a person. But there are different theories about who it could be kind of floating around out there. So there's one guy on the show called Glenn. And in this episode, he goes wandering off on his own for a little bit. And there's one website who claimed to have had the scoop on this. And they say, oh, it's Glenn they've caught on camera. But Rob Lee, who writes The Skeptic's Boot, which is a really good paranormal research blog. He's a skeptic, and he was on the show last episode, the episode before last, one of the last couple of episodes. Rob joined us, and he's written about Most Haunted that he thinks it's just an outright fake, and that what they've done is they've basically overlaid some footage onto the original footage of them pointing down the hallway. And I think he's got a point. I think Rob has a point here, because the way that they've done it, the way that Carl puts the camera down and then they're kind of pointing in a general direction at something they can see, but they're not really describing what they're seeing. They're saying, there's something down there. I can see it. I can see. Can you see that? What is that? And that kind of leaves them open so then they can put whatever they want to put or choose to put.
So you've got a long static shot that you can actually...
Yeah.
Stick something over the top of. I read his article as well, and I thought, yeah, it seemed like a very a decent explanation for it. But I don't think you even need to go as far as saying that it's a forgery. I think it's much easier to put it down to incompetence. I think that it is that. Is that simply it is just somebody walking about. I think the only reason why you're seeing the whole locked off shot and things like that is just it's a product of the way that they've edited it. You know, you don't usually see it. But they were giving you like a nice long chunk of it because it's probably the only evidence that they have that's of any good. So they're padding it out, building up a bit of suspense of it. So you just see a bit more behind the scenes of what it is. I don't think you need to go much further into flights of fancy.
The thing that struck me is just how utterly incompetent and abjectly incompetent the entire thing is. I mean, just from start to finish. I mean, this is not how you investigate anything. And it's certainly not how you investigate ghosts. I'm thinking like, oh, he sees something. Surely he's going to run towards it with the camera, right? Oh no, he's gonna put the camera down because
why is there someone just wandering really around by themselves? It's just completely unprofessional way to be doing it.
Yeah, and one of the most important things if you're working with other people is that you don't go on your own, because if you do see something, it's just your subjective word and that it's not an objective observation. But also because you contaminate each other's research area by walking into it and just like
aware of who each other. I remember when we did our Halloween episode and Paul told the story of investigating I think it was a Hellfire Club, and he was like, he went off exploring by himself. I'm hearing a sound, and was getting closer and closer and closer, and it turned out that that other person has been hearing him, and they were sort of investigating each other, thinking the other one was the ghost, until they gave like, the fight of their lives to each other.
The same thing happens with Bigfoot hunters. I mean, I've been in places where it's like you have this area reputed as, you know, the big, you know, hot zone of Bigfoot, and you have these groups who are, you know, frankly, often drunk, and they're like, they're all wandering around in the dark. Like, did you hear that? Did you hear that? It's like, yeah, that's the other group of idiots on the other side of the room. It's like, what is wrong with you people? I don't know.
I've seen them where they do that kind of whooping, like that whooping noise, and they can hear something. And I often wonder if it's just their own kind of echo or another group of Bigfoot hunters.
Yeah, there's enough. Yeah,
do you hear that? And they're just like
they're talking to each other.
Yeah, and I've always liked the idea that there is a Bigfoot somewhere, and it's just watching them going, are these guys for real?
Playing at?
Yeah.
Well, because a lot of times they have vocalizations, right? So there's all these Bigfoot groups who have what they consider to be actual, you know, Bigfoot voices. And, you know, whenever those have been investigated, it's bogus. But to them, it's something real. And so you have cases where they'll use these megaphones and go out in the wilderness and blast out. And then of course other people who are like, did you hear that? That was creepy. It's like, yeah, that's some idiot on the other ridge looking for Bigfoot. It's just Keystone Cops.
That reminds me actually of a reporting. I can't remember if somebody reported it to me or to somebody else who then told me about it. I genuinely can't remember. But it was this guy he was out camping. And he kind of went away from the campsite to go to the bathroom, and he was stumbling around, and he had the feeling that there was somebody, you know, when you get the sudden sensation that there's someone near you, and he kind of stopped, and then this voice went, Daddy, like a child's voice went, Daddy. And this guy freaked out, was like, holy shit, and we like ran back to his camp, and then all he could hear was this child screaming. And he was like, oh, that was definitely a ghost. Like, are you sure it wasn't actually a child and you scared that child to like half to death? And he went running off looking for his dad, and he thought you were his. And this poor guy's like, there's like a creepy child ghost out here, like looking for his dad. Like, actually, probably a living child, probably not dead.
I think you could quite, with that footage, you could quite easily conclude that either the most likely explanation is either an outright hoax and a double exposure on the video, or it's just their complete incompetence and unprofessional behavior. Either way, they don't come across it out of it very well.
This is most haunting we're talking about.
Or it's a ghost.
I don't think it ever really looked well, you know. I just can't believe that most haunted is still a thing, because it did go away for a while.
For years and years and years. Everyone was, I think, and it was because they've been so discredited so many times and been caught doing extremely dubious things, like with the whole Creed Kafer and all of those sort of stuff like that. People just sort of lost the will to watch it anymore, and then it just came back. I mean, it must be the cheapest program in the world to make, but even still, you would have thought you'd want your channel to have some sort of broadcast standards.
You could do their CGI, you know, on an iMac. I mean, come on, guys, this is not.
Oh yeah.
You know, I think really the thing that strikes me is that the ghost shows in particular have painted themselves into a corner, because initially when they first came on, you know, 12, 15 years ago, it was something that people hadn't seen before, and ghost hunters walking around, turning off the lights and scaring themselves. But we're in 2017 now, and they sort of reached this paradox, this where they have to stay in this Goldilocks zone, where the images they find, their so-called evidence, it can't be so clear that we identify it, but it can't be so ambiguous that people don't know what the hell it is.
So it always has to be right on that
kind of curve spot.
And the problem that they're facing is that they can't improve the technology, because then that will decrease their results. And so they can't do any better, because if they do better, then they're not going to find ghosts. And so they have to have this, they've boxed themselves into this evidence zone where they have nowhere to go, because they can't improve technology. They can't improve their mechanisms, because they're not going to find any evidence. Yeah. And if they do it, it's just too sloppy. So it's, I'll be really curious to know. I think they jumped the shark. I'd be curious to know where these shows are in 5 years.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the technology, because what they tend to do is they go in the opposite direction, where they promote the bogus technology. So you see things like the Ovilus, which is like real time ghost communication, and ghost laser grid pens, and then you've got the it's basically the Microsoft Kinect camera, but it's meant to detect ghosts, and you see these weird skeletal kind of images on the screen. So they just tend to kind of come up with these new technologies, which then feed into the whole ghost hunting events company income and the ghost technology company income, and it just generates, it's like a loop. It's so I think they'll just continue for as long as people are interested. They'll continue
as long as people are watching,
and I guess as long as skeptics are talking. So we're probably part of the problem. But people generally do believe that the most haunted footage is real, and I can remember back in like 2002, whenever it was they launched, I remember watching their shows and thinking it was all real. But
I was hooked when it first started.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the best evidence I've ever seen. And then actually sort of stepped back and started thinking about it for just a little while, and was like,
maybe not.
My standard of evidence might need a bit of work on, actually, if this is the best that I can come up with.
Well, it seems to me that of the whole lot, I think the dog Watson, the dog seems the most reasonable of the bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the dog is the one where like, Watson, do you see that? And the dog's like,
just staring.
What am I supposed to be looking at? And look, that's evidence. He's staring at something like... No,
what
really
was
not.
Interesting about Watson, the interesting thing about the dog was that, like, Yvette was saying, he's not normally like this. It's like, well, he probably is, you just haven't observed him doing it. And there have been a couple of cases I've investigated where the dog has been acting weird, and it's actually, no, the dog's not acting weird, it's doing exactly what a dog does, and you're just observing it as being relevant.
Dogs in new places as well, they are just absolutely fascinated, especially because they're not often allowed inside in other places. So yeah, of course they're going to behave strange, because everything is new for them, and they just will find weird bits which will take their attention in new spaces. It happens all the time.
Well, I had a case, this is ages and ages ago, I can't remember the exact year. It must have been over a decade ago, maybe nearly a decade. And where I live, there's an area called Salisbury Plain, and it's where the military do their practice. They go out there and they do practice firing and bombs and so on and so forth. And so we're not that close, but we can sometimes hear the artillery fire and so on here in Bradford-on-Avon. And this pub was quite close to Salisbury Plain. And one of the reports was that the dog would just be going about its daily business, just walking around, happy as Larry, and then it would just stop and stare into one corner of the room. And it turned out that corner of the room kind of lined up perfectly with Salisbury Plain. And so basically the dog was just hearing the artillery fire on Salisbury Plain and just staring towards the noise. And that was brilliant. When we worked that one out, we were like, actually, this is what your dog's doing. The owner kind of went on the defense to try, like, no, it's definitely, you know, it's something spooky going on here. It's always in this room. And okay. Mm-hmm.
And let me guess, the Salisbury is always going to be in that corner. Oddly enough,
yes.
presumably ghosts might move around. But
you'd think so. What,
you would think, but then oddly enough, it's always right where the bombing is. So there you go.
Yeah. Now, moving on from Most Haunted, because okay,
while you
we
do
can't
that,
really
I'm
talk
just,
about it.
I'm going to move back next door. So don't mind me. I'm just
wall.
On my way. Yes.
So bizarre. Now, yes. We spoke earlier this month about wanting to try something a bit different on the Spooktator. And rather than just discussing recent paranormal news stories and headlines and so on, we wanted to start examining particular subjects which relate to paranormal research, or the 14 in one way or another. And I'm just ignoring Charlie walking through his house because it's really distracting. It's fine. And it seems that 2016 was the year of the killer clown, with sightings of people dressed as creepy clowns spreading fast across the West. September saw the tragic death by stabbing of a 16-year-old in Pennsylvania, and a month later, police were called to a mass clown hunt turned riot at Penn State University. The spate of sightings is said to have originated with a clown called Gags, who stood menacingly holding balloons in the Green Bay area of California. A Facebook page set up for Gags the Clown gained thousands of likes within days as people shared their sightings of the creepy clown on social media. However, Gags wasn't just a clown who had wandered away from the circus, and it was claimed that he was part of a PR stunt for a film or a documentary coming out, and it's disputed that he was the beginning of this trend. I think it was in the middle of 2016, around August, things took a slightly sinister turn when school children in South Carolina reported a group of scary clowns whispering and making strange noises at the edge of a local woodlands. But there was no evidence that the clowns really existed at all. But that didn't stop further sightings being reported further afield and throughout the southeast of the US. And despite numerous eyewitness reports of clowns, there was little evidence that the clowns had actually existed. But this didn't stop law enforcement and the media from offering stern and solemn warnings, and even going as far as to issue statements on how to talk to your children about killer clowns. Here in the UK, children in County Durham reported that a man in a clown mask jumped out in front of them and followed them to school while brandishing a knife. In North Wales, a schoolboy filmed a clown standing near a children's play centre late one night, and police forces across the UK issued similar warnings to their US counterparts about being vigilant for killer clowns. I'm sorry, reading that out is just weird to say. Scott Wood reported for Little Atoms that the charity Childline, for those who don't know Childline, children can phone it up when they're feeling in danger or scared and vulnerable, and they get offered advice. Childline reported that they'd received a deluge of calls from children about creepy clowns, as well as straight reports in the local and national press condemnation from professional clowns against the grungy street clowns. And there Wood also mentions that there were reports on the effects of the craze on fancy dress shops, and a guide to talk to children about creepy clowns was issued. But Wood rightly points out that contemporary clown sightings in the UK of this nature report back to 2013. What I liked about the 2016 kind of wave of clown sightings was when Stephen King himself tweeted, "Hey guys, time to cool down the clown hysteria. Most of them are good. Cheer up the kiddies and make people laugh." So what's the deal? That's what I thought we could maybe discuss in this episode. I think it's very, very interesting. Obviously, at the moment, I'm studying psychology, and we've been studying kind of moral panics and stuff. So that's probably why I find this topic so interested and am drawn towards it. And when we decided to discuss this subject in this episode, I started researching the subject more. And at the time, I knew very little about clowns, other than that they perform at parties and at circuses and so on. I've seen a few clowns at the circus when I was younger. But one thing that jumped out at me when I began researching this was that there are different types of clowns. And I didn't know this. And in the US, at the height of the killer clown scare, there were plans for a Clown Lives Matter march, organized by people who play scary clowns in real life. So, Ben, what's the distinction here between so-called killer clowns and actual real-life horror clowns? Please tell us.
Once again, Ben assumes the mantle of the weird clown expert. it was bizarre. I had a book come out almost a year ago, exactly, actually on April Fool's Day last year, called Bad Clowns. And I had written about and researched the phantom clowns, the 14 clowns and the stuff that folklorists and Lauren Coleman and others had written about. And then there's also some of that also bleeds into like Spring-Heeled Jack and Monkey Man Panics. And so there's a really interesting crossover there. Right around, Halloween last year, just everything just went crazy. I mean, it was across the country and then Sweden and like the UK, just all over the place. And it was just bizarre. So basically what happened was that there's two different things here. The first one is, there were a handful of copycat clowns. So you had people who were dressing up as clowns to scare people. And the first one that got international notice was actually in Northampton, the Northampton clown. There was a guy in Northampton, England, who dressed as a clown. And he had people photograph him and put the photo on Facebook. It's like, find the Northampton clown. And this was, I think, in 2014, and it made the news, and people were doing it, and he wasn't threatening anybody. He was just walking around, in the dark, in public, dressed as a clown, and this unnerved people, as you might imagine. and that was really the first scary clown that really went viral. And then there were copycats and copycats of copycats. There were some in Paris. There were some in California and elsewhere. And then you fast forward to 2016, and you had people who were dressing up as clowns just to scare people. So they would, no one was actually stabbed or, molested or anything like that, but they would go and creep people out. And so you had copycats, then copycats of copycats, because of course on the news, someone sees, scary clown photograph near school. And someone's like, "Hey, I have a clown costume. I could do that." Because people have nothing better to do with their time, so this sort of set the avalanche, and so all these people, and most of them were teenagers. There were a couple of kids who were arrested for driving around a Walmart parking lot at night with a clown mask on, so things like that. So you had a small but significant number of actual real life people who were dressed as clowns, not actually attacking anybody, but just sort of trying to scare people as a prank. And then you had some people who were faking the attacks. So you had people who like pretended that they were attacked by a clown. There was one woman that said that she was she said that she was attacked by a clown and who jumped out at when she was trying to go to work. She worked at McDonald's, if I'm not mistaken, and so it turns out that she was late to work. And that was her excuse. No. This is the best she could come up with. Like, all right, why am I half hour late?
I wondered know. If it was like a Ronald McDonald kind of joke that was coming up there.
They would not be happy.
I remember seeing video footage on YouTube because there were a few people who actually supposedly recorded clown sightings that I saw, and there was one of them which was really extreme. It was just someone like coming at him with a knife, and then you looked at his profile page and this had happened to him like three or four times, and I was like, just randomly. It was like, I don't think I believe that this genuinely happened. This poor guy, wherever he goes, he is bumping into killer clowns.
Are you calling bullshit on this? Because I am, yes. To me.
Yeah.
so you had a handful of actual people, probably no more than a few dozen over the course of the whole thing, who were actually dressing as clowns doing that. And then the other part of it was sort of what Haley was referring to, like there was a moral panic aspect. you had what are, you know, phantom clowns. You had these rumors and urban legends, almost like for a Slenderman figure.
Yeah, there was these stories of like them attempting to abduct children and things like that, and that there were child molesters who were dressed as clowns to try and lure kids, which no kid is ever going to see a clown and just, oh, I'll go and get in a van with him. It was just
like, of all the things that of all the things that one could dress up to lure children, clowns is probably the worst one of all. That's not going to get him.
But that was something I was going to touch upon and ask, actually, because to me, the could a clown thing did turn into a bit of a moral panic, and I find it quite interesting that some urban legends are urban legends, and then there are some urban legends that cross over into the realm of becoming a moral panic. And I think killer clowns are one of them, because people were worried about children being abducted from school by clowns, and
as one does.
And then another urban legend, I suppose, that, you know, and you mentioned it there, was Slenderman. Slenderman was this kind of just this figure from the internet until, you know, Morgan, Geyser, and Anissa Wire. I think that's their names. They stabbed their friend. Yeah, and they were 12-year-olds at the time, and they stabbed their friend and said it was for Slenderman. And people then started kind of treating like Slenderman and Creepypasta as though it was like something that could be a danger to society. And I wondered what you thought. Where is that line where an urban legend becomes a moral panic? What is it that's the distinction there?
No, you make a very good point, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that a lot of people outside sort of the folklore and Freudian realms don't really understand as part of the mix. If you look at when the phantom clowns first emerged, it was during the 1980s. Lauren Coleman traces them back to, I think, 1981 in Massachusetts. But certainly in the mid-80s, there were lots of these scary clown rumors and urban legends going around. There were some in the UK and some in Honduras and elsewhere. But the central time was in the 1980s. And you know, understand what that means. That means that the genesis of the idea is that you have masked strangers coming towards kids in a sort of harmless guise, right? It's the, you know, oh, it's candy, right? It's like the devil luring someone in, right? And it's the stranger danger notion encapsulated in this creepy clown idea. And you know, one of the things that, of course, went on in the 1980s, certainly in the United States, was we had the moral panic of missing kids. We had the satanic ritual abuse cases. We had people who were, you know, there was the Fells Acres case and the Amaral case. There were
satanic panic, kind of.
The McMartin preschool case. And so during the 1980s here in America, there was widespread panic and concern about strangers approaching kids to kill them or molest them. And the scary clown panic that really emerged in the 80s was central to that. And I sort of attribute part of the resurgence in late last year to in part, frankly, due to Trump. There was lots of concern, and there remains some concern about what's going to happen. And there was lots of uncertainty here in the States about, you know, Clinton and Trump and where are we going. There's lots of people really social anxiety that I think that sort of crystallized into that. And I think that was one of the drivers of the scary clown panic last year.
Yeah, maybe it's like a manifestation of a deeper level, like an underlying cultural anxiety that just manifests itself in different ways. I was over in America over Halloween. I was in Chicago for a while last year and saw that it did build up towards Halloween, then sort of dropped off a bit after Halloween, and then after the election it was gone. It's nothing. You didn't hear about it again, I suppose, because obviously the news cycle didn't have time for sort of the puff piece bits anymore. But it was, yeah, it would make sense that this was the kind of general anxiety that was going on in American consciousness at that time. That's it's strange.
This leads,
it expresses it.
This leads a bit into a question we have from a listener called Sharon, who asked, we put feelers out, if you have questions, let us know. And we have one question in, and does modern mass media change the way in which urban legends are created? Which I think is a good question, because as you've said, you know, the fear of people dressed as clowns or people come to get your children isn't a new thing, but this time it seemed... it seemed to spread really, really fast. And so do you think mass media plays a role in the creation of the new kind of boogeyman, the bogeyman?
I think it does, absolutely. You know, if you look at it from a folkloric perspective, I mean, for centuries, rumors and stories and legends were shared over the back fence, right, in small communities. And up until the advent of the internet, you know, going on, you know, 15, 20 years now, there was no such thing as mass media. I mean, you could certainly get on the phone and ring your friend, you know, in another state, another part of the continent. But these days, anyone with the internet connection can particularly on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, these stories just go all over the place. And of course, you know, as they say, a story can circle the world twice while truth is still getting its shoes on. And so there's just so much more potential for both good and bad information to get spread, you know, going virally. But unfortunately, it tends to be the misinformation, the bad information, the outrage that gets spread far and wide. Whereas as we all know, and as many listeners know, the truth is having a hard time catching up, and you know, such is the lot of debunkers and skeptics.
So I guess the question is, there is, as I mentioned before, there was the plan for a Clown Lives Matter march, and from people who are professional horror clowns. How do you make the distinction between somebody who dresses up as a scary clown for a living and someone, or, you know, these sightings and reports of people who are potentially out to cause trouble? Well, and also, out of curiosity, I'm just very curious, did the horror clowns become a thing after horror films, or did the horror films kind of base themselves on the horror clowns?
Ooh, good question. Look at you.
I'm really curious. I just didn't know there were different clowns, and it blew my mind a little bit.
So. Yeah. Well, I'll take the second question first. I mean, I talk in my book, like in second and third chapters, about the history of clowns. It's really interesting because, you know, clowns, what happened is that at some point along the way, the clowns that Americans are familiar with, and probably many, many Brits as well, is the happy clown, right? The one that comes and, you know, performs in a circus and a backyard party, and they're doing jokes and making balloon animals. And that is one type of clown, and that's perfectly legitimate. But that's only one genre. There's a much broader range of clowns that traces back millennia. You know, you go back to the court jester. You can go back to Mr. Punch. A thoroughly despicable, evil clown, beloved by Brits all
around. By children everywhere.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. And so you can trace back, you know, the fact is that, you know, that it's a mistake to ask when clowns went bad, because they were never really good. Clowns were never good. Clowns weren't bad. They just were. Some were good, some were bad. It just sort of depends on what the performance was and what context. And so for a long time, clowns, I mean, the clown is a jester figure. It's a trickster figure, much like Satan. I mean, the devil is a trickster figure, much aligned with the clown. So the clowns have always had this duality about them that's kind of unnerving. And it just so happens that the clown that we think of today, or at least up until recently, is the happy clown. And then so you had, but it's interesting, you had, like, for example, Charles Dickens in his The Pickwick Papers in 1836, he sort of goes into the two sides of the clown, and, you know, Stephen King picked it up. And so you know, when you see Pennywise and the sort of modern evil clowns, there's nothing new about them. That's just sort of a return to the darker, sinister side that's always been there.
Yeah, there's always been something sinister. I can completely understand it, because as a kid, I was never comfortable with clowns. And there was something about that sort of, you know, it's an adult, but they represent something that's kind of like chaotic neutral in a way. You don't know how they're going to behave, but they are behaving in ways that are completely unpredictable. And you just felt like they could reach in and pull your guts out and play with them and be laughing. Oh, and God. That kind of nightmarish sort of...
Make balloon animals out of your intestines.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yes. Because they are just, they are not bound by the same rules as other adults that you, you know, and there is something inherently quite threatening about that. offered you a lovely image there.
Yeah.
Poor
Charlie.
what was the first part of your question? I think I forgot the first part of your question.
How can you distinguish between somebody who is a clown, maybe like a Halloween haunted house, and these? You know, is the distinction?
No, that's a good question. That's one thing that I sort of struggled with writing my book, is because, you know, I tried to interview some professional clowns who did not want to talk to me, as you can imagine. They were not eager to lend any sort of attention or credibility to the evil clown. And so, I actually got several emails from professional clowns during Halloween last year. I got people contacting me saying, look, I'm a clown. You know, I see you've written about this. What should I do to help, you know... to soothe my clients into not being terrified. And so, you know, what I tried to do was point out to people that the people that are scaring people, those who are dressing as clowns to scare people, they're not clowns. Anybody can dress as a clown. Anybody can put on makeup and put on a mask. These are not professional clowns. They're just someone, no more than somebody who you know, puts on a vampire costume as a vampire or a witch or a mummy. They're just putting on a particular persona. And so the people that are actively doing these sorts of pranks, they're not evil people. For the most part, they're just teenagers who are out for a bit of fun. But they're not actual clowns. And that's one reason why, you know, the clown community was upset, because they saw the sort of this blurring of the lines between professional clowns who, by and large, as Stephen King said, are generally good people. You know, I'm not a huge fan of clowns, but I've interviewed some, and they seem pretty nice. I have no real problem with them. So, you know, I don't think there's gonna be lasting damage to the clown community. I think that, you know, any more so than when Stephen King's novel came out and the miniseries with Tim Curry in 1991. You know, there were scary clowns, and of course they're remaking it with a new scary clown. It'll be out soon. And, you know, there'll be some concern about it, and then it'll die down and clowns will be back.
I think one of the things that the way you describe it there actually reminds me a lot of the kind of the ghost hunter community. When you get people arrested for trespassing or committing arson in buildings, and they claim that they were ghost hunters and they all ghost research it, and they're not, and they're just, you know, they claim to have been doing that. And you find the ghost hunting community kind of owns that in a way, and then is like, we need to be better than this. I guess there are parallels there between between clowns and ghost hunters, and that's not an insult, by the way. But
I think there's lots of parallels there, really.
One question that we had a lot, and one that I saw people asking when these reports of killer clowns are coming in, was to what extent the sightings and the reports were part of a PR stunt. And I mentioned Gags the Clown. I think off the top of my head, he was doing it to drum up interest in a film that was coming up, I think. I'm not quite sure what the film was. I can't remember. It was, you know, it was that memorable.
Yeah, that PR job worked, didn't it?
It definitely worked.
It'll be there at the Oscars anytime.
Yeah. And one of the questions we had was the 2016 media interest just a coordinated effort and perhaps a PR campaign? And then Blake Smith asked, I think this is rather tongue-in-cheek, what percentage were proven marketing stunts and what percentage were actual mother-effing evil clowns?
Good question, Blake.
Thanks, Blake.
No, that, That's an interesting question. And, you know, when the clown panic first emerged, that was one of the big suspects, right? I mean, they were like, people assumed that it was a PR stunt. And in my research, I found maybe two examples where, I mean, I found one definite example. There was a scary clown that was in Staten Island or Long Island, Long Island clown. And that was about a year after the Northampton clown made his rounds. And that turned out to be a publicity stunt for a company called Fuzz on the Lens Productions, which was a low budget horror film company. So we know for a fact that at least one or two of the clown reports were tied to publicity stunts, but most of them were not. And we know this partly because, you know, if you think about it, I mean, it, certainly at the height of the clown panic around Halloween, you know, they were shutting down schools. There were school lockdowns. There were people, you know, the police were being called. No marketing company wants to be any part of that. So I guarantee you that there's no horror film company that said, yeah, you know what we need to do right about now? We need to send the clown out there and scare the hell out of people because that's, I mean, that could invite lawsuits and criminal charges.
Yeah.
So other than one or two ones that were pretty clearly publicity stunts, the vast majority of them were just, you know, just yahoos out, you know, trying to scare people in parks and have fun with it.
It's always the thing with doing PR job and just publicity in general. You can never really have any idea. You can't really coordinate something like that to happen because there are some things that just sort of work in the consciousness and then take off. They just hit something and you can't orchestrate it. It's just, I mean, it's the simplest thing in the world to do, to put on a clown costume and just go and stand out somewhere in the dark. So it doesn't take
people
genius
that I did it. I mean, I had more than a few people accuse me, maybe tongue in cheek, maybe not. It was like, so Ben, I see you got our new book about scary clowns out.
It was magnificent.
Is it a coincidence about all the scary clowns? And I'm like, yes, it is. You know, and here's why: is because I have smart friends. I'm not that bright, but I have smart friends, and they would figure this shit out. So like I don't trust my ability to pull the wool over other people's eyes because I figure people are going to find me out and call me out and then I'm the idiot. So no.
There is a lot riding on it, isn't there? Because if you do it and then you get found out, you've caused this mass panic and you're the bad guy and that's it. You can't come back from that. What I found quite interesting, we did a little poll on the Spooktator Twitter account, and we asked people, when I think of killer clowns, I think they are ... And then we gave four options. One was, I think they are men. I think they are women. I think they are people of both sexes. And then the fourth one was, I don't consider their gender. And we ran that for a couple of days and 75 people responded to that poll. So thank you to those who did. And astonishingly, 73% of people completed the sentence with, when I think of killer clowns, I think they are men. Nobody chose women. 4% of those who responded said people of both sexes and 23% said, I don't consider their gender at all. And what was, I found that really interesting that when we think of killer clowns, we think of men. And I guess, does that go back to
I definitely
whole...
do. I never thought about it before. But now when you think, I always imagine a male clown. I don't ever think of them as being in any way sort of gender variant. I sort of imagine if there was a clown species, then they would probably struggle to breed.
No, that's creepy. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, Charlie, you're really going to places I had never considered this.
This is a novelist's brain. This is where it takes you.
Clowns breeding.
My guess is that that's probably due to the menacing aspect of clowns. In general, men are considered to be more menacing if you look at, you know, horror movie villains, because they're assumed to be stronger and more powerful and whatever else. And so the other aspect to it could be that in at least some of the scary clown images that were shared on the internet and on social media, they were probably men. I mean, you know, they have makeup on, but they have a build of a man.
Physically, they had the presence of a masculine presence.
That's how I would interpret that.
What's quite interesting here, though, is when it comes to, you know, because let me start again. A lot of these sightings are, they don't have any basis to them. So there is no evidence that a clown was seen at the edge of the woods, or that there was a clown chasing a woman down the street, and so on and so forth. But there are examples where people have been arrested for dressing up as clowns, or wearing a clown mask and kind of harassing people or scaring people, whether intentionally or not. And in the UK, I think it was in 2014 or 2013, there was a woman arrested for wearing a clown mask near a school and causing concern. So out of those that we know who have been arrested for dressing up as so-called killer clowns or creepy clowns, there are definitely women in that group of people. Mm. But when you come to judging it, people do think them out. And I think that probably, and there is nothing to support this, but I think it probably has a lot to do with the whole kind of the idea that the clowns are coming to take the children away or do something to the children. And you kind of link that to being a male thing, and, you know, the men who are the stalkers, because it goes against being a woman to harm children. Though obviously, you know, that's not true, because women do harm children and it's terrible, but
mostly newborns though.
Yeah. And but yeah, I found that very interesting that zero people. And
I think there is just a part of it, the fact that usually being this sort of being the killer clown or the creepy clown requires you walking around at night by yourself usually, and for people, women are told that you're just, that it's just not a safe thing to be doing by yourself wandering around at night, that men actually do just generally feel a bit more comfortable doing that, especially in urban settings.
Nobody dressed as a clown is going to have anybody coming up to them.
Well, no, that's true. Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to start doing that now.
Anybody listening, if you want to be avoided at night,
yes,
dress as a clown.
That is a very good point, actually. Yes.
Yeah, there have been a few instances where people were attacked for having like a clown mask. So
yeah, that was more of what I was thinking about, is that you would actually be putting yourself at risk of being attacked by being by going around and trying to scare people. But,
and to that end, I mean, there were also people that fired weapons at clown sightings.
Yeah, there's also always that, as I was saying.
There was some in Greenville, South Carolina. There was a case where it actually happened a few months ago, where there was a guy that shot it was like his automatic weapon or something, and it turned out it was a woman walking her dog, and she was wearing a white shawl, and luckily no one was injured. But yeah, if somebody, I mean, you know, we can talk about eyewitness testimony for a minute if you want to go there.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, there's so many examples where someone said, oh, I thought I saw a clown, because, you know, once you have that psychological priming, once you're on the lookout for clowns, you see clowns everywhere. Okay. And if you think that, and this is one of the interesting and sort of the darker aspects of it, was, you know, there were schools that were locked down. There were parents, and I know for a fact, I actually had a friend of mine call me up, and she wanted me to speak to her young daughter, because her daughter was afraid of clown panics and rumors on her school. And luckily she knew me as a friend, and I talked to her daughter on the phone and said, don't worry about it. It's just a rumor. It's not true. But, you know, these sorts of rumors can have real consequences, from shutting down schools, scared parents. And so, you know, it's easy for us to sort of sit back and sort of say, oh, well, you know, this whole thing amounted to nothing. But, you know, these sorts of rumors and legends can be very damaging.
Well, and Childline here in the UK, they had a surge in calls from children who were scared that clowns were going to get them at school. And interestingly, a lot of Scott Wood, again, over on Little Athens, he pointed out that a lot of the children who were talking about clowns were talking about them being in the backs of vans. So some of the schools were being locked down, and then there would be just a van parked outside, and the kids would get freaked out because they're like, they're in the van, they're in the van. It would just be an ordinary van, no clowns in it, nobody sinister in it. But there was that association, and I guess it just shows that these kind of urban legends are kind of just remade as time goes on.
That's a big Chicago thing that I heard, because when I was over in Chicago when it was going on, heard from several people of this reappearing time and time again every few years starting in the 80s. about clowns driving around in white vans, abducting children. And then it would go away and it would come back and it would be treated seriously by the news reports again and again, even though there never seems to be a shred of evidence of it ever actually happening.
Do you think there's a risk that people, you know, there are this kind of this panic about this happening? Do you think there's a risk that people who are bad and have bad intentions could then kind of latch onto this and potentially actually dress up as clowns to go out and harm people? And then people will be like, oh, no, that didn't happen. You're misremembering or you're lying. Or
I think that what I would liken that to would be the tainted Halloween candy scare, which has many similarities. You have the stranger danger element. You have the idea that something sweet and innocent, such as candy or clowns, you know, that are accessible to children. And, you know, in the case of tainted Halloween candy, which I've researched, as has Joel Best and other people, it's interesting because there were copycats in what folklorists call ostension. So we had people who were enacting legends. And so there were a couple people. There was one, like, I think 2 years ago in Halloween, there was a guy, a father, who inserted, I think it was a razor blade or a nail, in candy. And he called the police because he wanted to be a hero. And so here you have a case. And when he was arrested, he said that the reason he did it was because he wanted to teach his kids a lesson about the importance of not taking candy from strangers. The irony, of course, is that
candy was perfectly fine.
The candy was perfectly fine until this kid.
It was their father.
There was another case of a dad actually killing his own son with tainted candy, wasn't there? Thinking that he would be able to get away with it because back from trick-or-treating.
That was Ronald Clark O'Brien. It was a Texas guy, I think, in 1974, 75. And yeah, he killed his child with tainted pixie sticks it was for insurance. And what's interesting is that was a homicide that was masked and portrayed as an urban legend.
It's trying to bring an urban legend to life.
Yeah, it's
did he get away with it for a while, or did they know straight away?
In the O'Brien case, I think that they figured out pretty quickly. But of course, you know, the danger is that to this day, as he just said, you know, people still think back to that one case and they misinterpret it because they think, oh, well, there was that guy that, you know, killed that. There was that poor kid that was killed by contaminated pixie sticks. Like, well, yes and no. I mean, it was not stranger danger. It was not randomly done. It was a murder, and murders happen. So you have this blurring of scary urban legend and sort of real life elements that, you know, that reverberate. Here we are, you know, decades later.
So I guess this is a good place to go to one last question that we had sent in by Christine. Christine asked, does Ben have opinions on what urban legends we can see becoming an actual scare in the future?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, in my experience, you know, what you find is a lot of urban legends tend to fall into certain well-known motifs. You know, the xenophobia, you have stories of, you know, alligators in sewers, you have the little lady that macrawaves her poodle, you know, all these sorts of things. And so they tend to basically reappear in different places, different locations, and with sort of some of the details changed. So that's a good question. I don't think that we're going to see the emergence of brand new urban legends. I think what's going to happen is that that other ones that have maybe been around, the Vanishing Hitchhiker story, for example, it's old as dirt, and that's going to keep being told, and it'll be told, you know, in 200 years, you know, did you see that jet car? Well, the jet car story, and the turned around, the Vanishing Hitchhiker was gone. I mean,
interestingly, when you talk about the Vanishing Hitchhiker, that we've actually covered stories on this show not so long ago about areas where were hit by the tsunami in 2015. Japan, yeah. Was it 2015?
The taxis. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And they have these ghostly taxi passengers that vanish. And I was actually in a taxi very recently, and the taxi in the UK, I wasn't in Japan, and the taxi driver, we got talking about ghosts and stuff, and he knew a taxi driver who had had the same thing happen to him. I think it was just a fare dodger, personally, who just kind of jumped out at the opportune moment. But yeah.
Now you're just being skeptical.
Yeah, what do I know?
But yeah, I think all of these urban legends, they just get sort of the reboot treatment. They just get updated for whatever is the kind of scare at the time, what is most likely to, you know, they just get updated to stay up with technology and things like that. But yeah, the core of them is still the same throughout them. And the moral lesson is usually the same, that, you know, and it's usually something that people have been punished for their own greed or selfishness or short-sightedness or whatever. I mean, even something like you're saying with the tainted candy, at the heart of it, why it scares kids is it's because their greed and their love of candy is going to get them killed.
Well, it's gluttony, right? It's the one of the
exactly.
Things.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. And it's gluttony mixed with, you know, a stranger danger. And of course, you know, and that's one of the things that I find really frustrating is that if you look at it statistically, of course, strangers are very unlikely to harm children. Most children are harmed and abused by their parents or caregivers, not by strangers.
Yeah. The vast majority of time it's someone they know.
We have this misplaced concern about who's going to attack people. And it's really kind of a shame because, you know, people, you know, society only has finite resources, and if we're throwing money at phantoms, then that means that the people that, you know, the solutions that could actually help kids are not being followed up.
Well, this has been another episode of The Spooktator. Our next episode is going to be on May 25th, and we're going to be joined by Claire Elliott, who will be helping us to ask, what the hell is the deal with electronic voice phenomena? Claire is currently studying paranormal belief and electronic voice phenomena for her master's at Manchester Metropolitan University, and she delivered a really interesting presentation at Skepticamp in 2016 in Manchester, and I think it's going to be a really good episode, and that's on May 25th. Remember, you can find all of the links to stories discussed in this episode at spooktator.co.uk. Ben, where can people find your work and your books and so on? When's your next book out?
My next book will probably be out maybe in September or October, and it's about ghost investigation specifically. I'd done a previous book on scientific paranormal investigation across the board, and I realized that ghost investigation is such a niche field, but yet so popular that I really need to do one just on that. So I do that. You can find me on Facebook, BenjaminRadford.com. And I'm pleased to say that I have a new podcast actually called Squaring the Strange, that we're now in our first month of doing. And we're limping along and trying to sort of see how it goes. And it's kind of fun taking a skeptical take on things.
Great.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I'm sorry about the technical difficulties at the beginning of the show, but do listen. You can listen back to this show as the audio podcast. You can find all the subscription links on our website, and join us again on May 25th, where we'll be discussing EVP. Until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.